From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Pakistan hits suspected militant sanctuaries. A Chinese court sentences suspected terrorists. Thailand defends its human rights record. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Pakistani fighter planes have bombed suspected militant sanctuaries in the troubled North Waziristan border region for a second day as part of a long-demanded military offensive. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif says the operation, which began Sunday, will continue until all terrorists are eliminated. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
The military says the counter-terrorism airstrikes are targeting locations in North Waziristan where militants have established bases and there is no civilian population nearby. Most of the militants killed are being described as members of the Fugitive Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is operating in the area under the umbrella of the Pakistani Taliban. Army officials say several ethnic Uyghur fighters linked to the insurgency in China's Xinjiang province are also among those killed. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif defended the military action before Pakistan's parliament, saying Monday the Pakistani Taliban did not reciprocate to his peace initiatives to restore normalcy to the Waziristan territory and bring an end to years of deadly militancy in the country. Instead, he says, terrorists continued bloodshed and violence across the nation without sparing women and children. He says a decisive operation has been launched to rid Pakistan of terrorism and God willing it will continue until all its objectives are realized. Mr. Sharif vowed not to allow Pakistan become a safe haven for terrorists again at any cost. With the approval of all the political parties, the parliament passed a resolution backing the army action, but lawmakers of the two main Islamic parties refused to put their signatures on the document.
This house resolves to stand shoulder to shoulder with the armed forces till final victory.
A military statement issued Monday quoted Pakistani Army Chief General Raheel Sharif as emphasizing that all terrorists along with their sanctuaries must be eliminated without discrimination. But Pakistani newspaper editorials and independent analysts remain skeptical about whether the military establishment has abandoned its alleged dualist policy of good Taliban and bad Taliban. Islamabad has long been under fire for battling anti-state Islamist militants and their associates, but tolerating the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network of insurgents who are using North Waziristan for staging cross-border attacks on NATO and Afghan forces. Pakistan's reluctance to deny sanctuaries to these extremists has remained a major irritant in its ties with the United States. The director of the Washington-based Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, Shuja Nawaz, says it is too early to comment on how the Obama administration views the Pakistani counter-terrorism offensive because Washington is heavily distracted by a number of crises in other parts of the world.
If there has been some kind of arrangement made with the Haqqani group to allow them to exit the territory before these cordon and search operations began, then that is something that has yet to be shared with the public.
Prime Minister Sharif's controversial peace process remained under fire since it was launched nearly 5 months ago, and demands continued to grow for a military offensive against militant bases in the tribal region in the wake of rising terrorist attacks across the country. The pressure on Mr. Sharif's administration intensified after a militant raid killed about 40 people last week at the Karachi airport. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility, saying Uzbek fighters carried out the raid. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Still to come on Daybreak Asia, prenatal nutrition and the link to long life. A court in China's western region of Xinjiang sentenced three people to death Monday for organizing a terrorist plot that targeted Tiananmen Square in China's capital last October. The speedy trial ended with prison terms for another five people and is part of a crackdown against terrorism in one of the country's most restive regions. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong for VOA.
Chinese state television said the Urumqi Intermediate People's Court found three people guilty of organizing and leading a terrorist organization and endangering public safety. The announcer says the accused are sentenced to death and stripped of their political rights for life. Another five people were given jail terms ranging from life imprisonment to 5 years in prison for participating in a terrorist group and endangering public safety. According to the court, they provided assistance for a terrorist attack in Beijing when a car ran people over outside the Forbidden City in Tiananmen Square. The incident in Tiananmen caused the death of three tourists and also killed the passengers of the car, whom authorities say all belonged to the same family from Xinjiang. Chinese state television showed the defendants appearing in court wearing orange vests. Video footage taken by surveillance cameras in Tiananmen at the time of the attack was shown in court. A white Jeep is seen speeding onto the sidewalk and through a crowd of people. Monday's sentence comes a month after the Chinese government launched a year-long campaign against terrorism, which authorities say is carried out by separatists who want to establish an independent state in Xinjiang. The region is home to many Uyghurs, a Turkic Muslim minority that has grown increasingly unhappy with Chinese restrictions on their culture. Uyghur rights groups say the government is exaggerating the threat of terrorism instead of addressing the real problems of discrimination and religious suppression against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Dilksat Rexit, spokesman for the World Uyghur Congress, says that in the current crackdown against terrorism, political motivations trump legal proceedings. He says, what we gather from our sources in Xinjiang is that lawyers, especially Uyghur lawyers, are now asked to clarify their political stand and take part in the crackdown against separatists. He says that means that under the current political campaign, they're not put in a position to provide even the basic legal help to defendants. Chinese state media said that the eight defendants sentenced on Monday had accepted defense by a lawyer appointed by the court and saw their rights protected during trial, which lasted one day and was held on Friday. The trial found that the defendants had established a terrorist group in 2011 and had since started recruiting members. According to the court, the defendants had met the car's driver and his family in Beijing and had provided them with financial assistance weeks before the attack in Tiananmen. News reports on Monday did not offer further details about the evidence collected against the defendants or how the defendants knew the family who drove the Jeep against bystanders in Beijing. A police report released at the time of their arrest in October said that they had confessed taking part in the terrorist plot. Rebecca Valley reporting for VOA News in Hong Kong.
On a visit to Bhutan, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has pledged to build stronger ties with the neighboring Himalayan country wedged between India and China. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the visit is being seen as an effort by the new government to counter China's growing influence in India's neighborhood.
During his two-day stop in the Bhutanese capital, Thimphu, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi laid the foundation of a 600-megawatt hydroelectric power station to be built jointly, opened a Supreme Court building made with Indian assistance, and assured Bhutan of continuing support for the tiny country's development. He told the Bhutanese parliament that India is committed to good relations with its neighbours. Mr. Modi says stability and development in India will help all countries in the South Asian region. He says a weak India will not be able to assist small countries in its neighbourhood. Prime Minister Modi's decision to make Bhutan his first port of call since taking over as Prime Minister is regarded as part of his emphasis on strengthening ties with neighbouring countries. In an unusual gesture, he had invited the heads of all South Asian nations to attend his swearing-in ceremony last month. Analysts in New Delhi say India's new government is reaching out to neighbours to reassert its influence in South Asia, which has waned in recent years. This had helped China make inroads into countries like Nepal, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh by offering to build ports, roads and using its economic clout to make other investments. India also had a dispute with Bhutan last year when it cut fuel subsidies to the country, seen as a mark of New Delhi's anger with the Himalayan country's efforts to engage with Beijing. The subsidies were later restored. Security analyst Bharat Karnad at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi says the trip to Thimphu has been made with an eye on China, with which Bhutan shares a common border.
Bhutan is in a few weeks' time going to be negotiating with the Chinese about their disputed border. So that's of some slight worry that the Bhutanese do not tip over onto the Chinese side. So this is one way of trying to generate goodwill, keep them on our side, keep them pacified with offers of development assistance, etc.
The Indian leader called for more responsive financial assistance for Bhutan and suggested doubling of scholarships given to Bhutanese students in India. Mr. Modi spoke of developing tourism as a means to help poor people. For Bhutan, a tiny landlocked country in the high Himalayas, more development assistance could be crucial. Although the country has remained largely aloof from the outside world and focuses on using an index called Gross National Happiness to measure progress, the government admits it also needs to focus on the obstacles to happiness as it grapples with high unemployment and growing national debt. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
If you just happen to be joining us, welcome and good morning. You may hear Daybreak Asia in its entirety later on our program page at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. Or you can download our podcast and take our program along with you and listen at your convenience. Thai government officials are defending their country's rights record as the U.S. State Department prepares to issue its annual human trafficking report. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok, Thailand, which faces a possible downgrade to the worst offenders category.
Government officials in Bangkok are reiterating their country's progress in combating human trafficking exceeds Washington's criteria needed to upgrade Thailand's ranking. The kingdom was previously placed on the Tier 2 watch list on the State Department's Trafficking in Persons report. The 2014 report, covering 188 countries, is to be issued later this week. Western diplomats tell VOA they expect Thailand to be dropped to Tier 3. That would equate Thailand with such countries as Cuba, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Syria, as well as a number of African nations deemed to not fully comply with minimum standards and not making significant efforts to do so. The Director General of the American Department at Thailand's Foreign Ministry, Songsak Saichua, tells VOA if the United States is objective, he is confident the kingdom will move up, not down in the report.
But if it happened that we will be downgraded to be Tier 3, we prepare to go ahead with all efforts to combat human trafficking. We will intensify the prosecution and law enforcement, step up protection and prevention system, increase and expand international partnership with other countries.
Thailand could face economic sanctions and loss of development aid if it is blacklisted, but Songsak does not expect any direct impact based on how other countries have fared, which were placed in the bottom tier.
I have some sort of the psychological effect on the consumer of the U.S. or Europe and so on. Then we also have worked closely with the buyers in the U.S. and also the European market to make sure that they understand our efforts and they understand the process and what's going on in Thailand.
The determination could not come at a worse time for Thailand, with events combining to form what the Bangkok Post calls an imperfect storm of humiliation. Thailand is on the defensive over its Navy's alleged involvement in trafficking Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, also known as Burma, and Bangladesh. The country last week was the only one to vote against a protocol strengthening the International Labor Organization's Convention Against Slave Labor. It is believed that at least half of the estimated 2 million people from Myanmar working in Thailand do not have proper documentation. A larger exodus could have disastrous consequences for Thailand's economy, dependent in several key sectors on cheap foreign labor from neighboring countries. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Thailand's military government is ending a rice support scheme put in place under the former civilian government as investigations continue into widespread corruption and losses of billions of dollars. As Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, the policy change comes as Thailand is predicted to return as the world's largest rice exporter, eclipsing current market leader India.
Thailand's military leader, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, said all rice price support schemes were dismissed unless there were direct benefits to the farmers, adding alternative measures were needed to boost agricultural development and support to farmers. Under the scheme that was a central policy of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra's government and key to the Pua Thai Party's 2011 election victory, the government had paid farmers 50% more than world market prices, in the belief Thailand, then the world's largest rice exporter, could act as a price leader and force up global rice prices. But the scheme, costing over $19 billion and shrouded in official secrecy, floundered as Thailand, unable to sell its rice at the higher prices, was left with millions of tons of the grain in warehouses while the government was engulfed by allegations of widespread corruption. Government financing for the scheme dried up last year, leaving hundreds of thousands of farmers unpaid. In March, Ms. Yingluck's caretaker government, in a bid to raise money, began releasing rice at discounted prices onto the world market. David Dorr, a senior economist with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, says sales of Thai rice this year led to lower global prices.
One of the ways that they were raising money is they realized that they were going to have to sell some of the huge stocks that they had. They just couldn't, you know, continue to borrow money and sit on all these stocks. And so they just started selling stocks. Thailand only went out of the market because they were trying to hoard everything.
In early May, prior to the military takeover of the Thai government, the National Anti-Counter-Corruption Commission, NAACC, found Ms. Yingluck at least partially responsible for corruption related to the scheme, and a subcommittee is now examining the former Prime Minister's declared assets, along with those of other cabinet members linked to the program. Farmers from neighbouring rice-growing countries, including Vietnam and Cambodia, were illegally shipping their rice to Thailand to be sold at the higher prices. Rice millers are also under investigation for overstating rice stocks. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Time for our weekly series, Women Rising, which this week looks at research that suggests that a mother's nutritional health could affect her child's health in a way that can have lifelong implications. Dr. Robert Waterland is an associate professor of molecular and human genetics at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonzo that data from a study of mothers in Gambia shows there are real differences in a child's genetic makeup as the child's resilience in certain diseases later in life. He says that his group studied mothers who conceived their babies during the rainy season when food was plentiful to those babies conceived in the dry season when the diet was different. He says the results show exciting promise in the eventual creation of a diet for mothers that would help their children before conception and during pregnancy that would give them a lifelong chance to live healthier and disease-resistant lives.
What we studied was the effects of maternal nutrition in the Gambia in West Africa and how a mother's diet before and during early pregnancy affects her nutritional status and actually affects a process we call epigenetics in her developing baby. What our data show that is new and exciting is that mother's nutrition around the time of conception actually causes permanent marks on her child's DNA, and this appears to occur in essentially all the cells of the body.
Okay, so let me make sure I got it.
Okay.
We have the mothers on one hand who ate better because the weather was better. There was more food available. You compared that to mothers who conceived during a time where food was not quite that plentiful. That apparently had some kind of effect on the genetic makeup of the child with regard to how the infant responded to certain genetic factors later in life. Am I understanding?
That's correct. What we now know is that these data related to season of conception are causing us to reconsider that whole relationship and to think, well, also mortality may be related to season of conception in addition to being related to season of birth. So it's causing us to reconsider exactly when these early environmental effects are having their impact.
In a certain respect, it does have a very futuristic, Star Wars-y, outer space kind of a sense where you can kind of pick and choose how you want your child to come out.
Well, I don't know if we're going to get quite to that point. I mean, that's a very interesting way to put it. What our studies are showing, these are data that are not yet published, but that we're finding that mom's nutrition right around the time of conception, her nutritional status can affect the chances of dysregulation of epigenetics. I mean, what it suggests is that there will be a specific nutritional profile that will be optimal to minimize this epigenetic dysregulation. You cannot take the influence of genetics out of all this. Our studies are not saying that genetic mechanisms are not important determinants of health and disease. This level, you know, that's called epigenetic regulation. I think it's very optimistic to think that if we learn to, you know, if we understand these processes better and can learn how to manipulate them by nutrition, for example, or even by pharmacological interventions, then this has great promise for improving human health. Because unlike the genome, unlike your genes, which are difficult to change, it may be possible to steer them in the right direction during development and also even to correct them if we can identify epigenetic dysregulation that might contribute to disease. But what I want to emphasize is that we believe our data have implications, have worldwide relevance, really. And another way we can underscore that is that these particular regions of the genome that we identified, we first identified these in Caucasians in the U.S., and then they were validated in Vietnamese individuals. And only then did we study these processes in these West Africans. So this really indicates that all over the world, that similar types of effect of maternal nutrition on the child's epigenetic regulation are likely to be happening.
Dr. Robert Waterland, Associate Professor of Molecular and Human Genetics at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He spoke with Daybreak Asia's Frances Alonzo, who, by the way, you may hear each week at this time with her Women Rising series. If you would like to read and see more of Frances's stories, all you have to do is stop by our program page. It's online at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. And her series is also available through the VOA mobile app. If you happen to have a smartphone, all you have to do is download that. It will give you all of the latest stories from the Voice of America right on your telephone. Speaking of smartphones, a new Nielsen survey study reveals that smartphone ownership continues to surge in Indonesia. Anil Anthony, the Consumer Insight Executive Director of Nielsen Indonesia, says the survey shows that smartphone ownership has shot up by 5% over the previous year. The survey encompassed a wide range of participants, 1,900 to be exact, and it was conducted over the course of 2013 in several large cities, including Medan, Bandung, Surabaya, and Makassar. According to the study, average Indonesian smartphone users spent more than 2 hours daily on their phones, with most of the time spent chatting, browsing, or using internet apps, perhaps even the VOA app. According to a Nielsen report last year, usage varies wildly between countries in East Asia. Some, such as Singapore, Malaysia, have a smartphone penetration exceeding 80%. The Philippines stands at just 15%, India at 18%. Surprisingly, the Nielsen survey states that on average, women spend more time than men chatting. I'm surprised. We thank you for listening to Daybreak Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson. Stay tuned for International Edition next.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or